It was an anxious young man who hurried to the Padres that evening along familiar paths, carrying a burlap bag full of leftovers, an old empty pistol, and a head full of choices. The faces and animals at the public tent, the shores, hills, and trees, all pulled at him with promises of safety and security. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep. Valentine went into the backyard, checked on the animals, and began to chop wood. Turning cordwood into kindling always cleared his mind, even if it left his body wet and rubbery. He had been doing this chore for the Padre and for a number of the neighbors in trade for sugar or flour since his arrival 5 years ago. The solid feel of the axe in his hands, the thwack as the blade sank into the dried wood, absorbed the things that bubbled up from the dark corners of his mind. He stacked the splintered results of his labor and went inside the house. Valentine found the three men sprawled in the smoke-filled library around an empty bottle and a mostly empty jug. A small bag of letters, including a couple from a young lady named Gaffley, sat on the Padre's nicked-up table, and a much larger bundle of letters lay tucked in one of the men's satchels, ready for the long return trip south. The one called Finner paged raptly through a battered volume titled Classic Nudes through the photographer's lens.
Ah, David, you missed some boring catching up and some even more boring drinking.
He didn't bother rising from his barely upholstered chair.
Did you win the race?
Sort of. Doesn't matter.
He told the story, ending with his being disqualified.
Jeez.
I'm with you, Jess.
I'd like to hear how you knew my father, Mr. Samuels.
Samuels looked at the Padre.
It's always Paul when I'm off my feet, son. When I was a kid, about your age, give or take, your dad and I used to come up together from down south, just like me and Jess do now. We like to keep in touch with the folks up here in this old fraud. Well-lubricated philosophy sessions, you might say.
Valentine began distributing the bounty from the public tent. The men dug in with the enthusiasm of days spent on the road, eating only what the wilderness provided.
You fight them, right? The Kurians, the Reapers, the things they make? And the patrols, right?
Patrols are what we call the Quislings up here nowadays.
Well, not all at once, son. In fact, we spend more time running scared from them than we do standing and fighting. We can hit them here and there where we don't stand too much of a chance of getting hit back. When we're not doing that, we're trying to keep from starving. Ever drunk water out of a hoof print to wash down a couple handfuls of ground-up ants? Slept outside in the rain without even a tent? Worn the same shirt for a month straight? Really stinks, son. And I don't just mean the shirt.
Valentine stood as tall as he could, trying to add a couple of inches to his 6'1".
I'd like to join up, sir.
I knew you could talk him into it.
A week later, Father Max saw the party off on a warm, sun-dappled morning. He gave David an old, musty-smelling hammock. It had uses other than rest. The Padre showed him how to roll his spare clothing up in it, then tie it across his back. By the time that was finished, other recruits who had collected over the past days began to shoulder their own burdens. Most carried backpacks bulging with preserved food. Valentine found that there were mouthfuls of words to be said and no time or privacy to say them.
God be with you, David.
The graying old man's eyes were wet with tears.
All right. Don't worry about me. Jacob Christensen said he'd help out around here. He wants to teach the younger kids, too, so you don't have to...
The Padre held out his gnarled hand for a handshake.
Yes, David, I'll be fine. Soon you'll have more important things to worry about than getting the cow milked and the chickens fed. But the day I quit teaching the kids their ABCs is the day I'll be resting in the ground.
Samuels and Finner also shook hands with the Padre. How the men looked so alert was beyond Valentine. They seemed to be up every night drinking and talking, then visiting the trading wagons and surrounding homes in the day. David guided them, leading them on backwoods paths to the households that matched the names on the mail. One visit stood out, when Samuels had called on an old woman to deliver a few personal effects from her dead son, who had been a friend of Samuels. That night, there had been more drinking and less laughter in the library. Valentine began to learn on the first day of the journey south. He learned just how sore his legs could get. Though he had walked all day many times in his life, he had never done so with better than 40 pounds of food, water, and possessions on his back at a pace set by a demanding sergeant. Other volunteers joined the group as they walked, one whom he knew. Gabriella Cho had gone to the Padre's school for a number of years. Her rich black hair had fascinated Valentine as he struggled through the awkward rites of puberty. Necessities at home kept her out of school past the age of 15. She had blossomed into a woman since Valentine had last seen her 2 years ago.
Gabby! So you're coming too?
He was relieved to be finally taller than the doe-eyed young woman. She looked at him once, twice.
Davy? Yeah, I'm taking the big trip.
We missed you. Father Max had to start asking the rest of us the tough questions. It wasn't the same since you left.
No, nothing's been the same since then.
When she replied to further questions with one-word answers and downcast eyes, Valentine ended the conversation. They spent the first evening at an overgrown crossroads more than a dozen miles south of the Padres. They made camp and spent the next day talking, waiting, and nursing sore muscles. Another soldier showed up, escorting four more recruits. Two of the men were twin brothers, 6'6" blonde giants. Valentine was surprised to learn their names were Kyle and Pete rather than Thor and Odin. They repeated the process as they hiked south and west in easy stages. Easy, that was, in the estimation of the men who bore the title Wolves. To Valentine, each day proved more exhausting than the last. By the time they reached the outskirts of Minneapolis, the group had swelled to 30 soldiers and over 100 young men and women. Lieutenant Skellen met them at a boat they used to cross the Mississippi. The lieutenant wore an eye patch so wide it could just as well have been labeled an eye scarf, which mostly covered a crescent-shaped scar on the left side of his face. He had dozens more recruits with him. Like the sergeants, they were in their teens, or barely out of them, wide-eyed and homesick among new landscapes and unfamiliar faces. The travelers made a wide loop west around the Twin Cities into empty lands teeming with prairie plants. One day, they skirted a 100-head herd of mountains of hair and hide, and the wolves informed Valentine he was looking at his first buffalo.
Ain't no weather can kill those big shaggies.
Finner nodded knowingly at his charges from the boundary waters.
The cows and wild horses gotta find low wooded spots when the snow's blowing out here, but them buffalo just form a big circle and wait it out.
Valentine picked up much more on that journey south. He learned that he could make a compass by stropping an old double-edged razor blade against the back of his hand. Charged with static electricity, he suspended it from a string in a preserve jar to shield it from the wind. The little piece of metal found north after wavering indecisively like a bird dog sniffing the breeze. The recruits learned how and where to build a fire, using reflectors made of piled logs to hide the flame and direct the heat back toward the camper. He was taught about trench fires in high wind, and to always roast game skewered on a spit beside a fire, not over it, with a pan underneath to catch every drop of the valuable fat. They learned how to make flour, not only from wheat, but also with the flower heads at the end of cattails, and even with bark. Valentine pounded masses of bark in a pan of water, removed the fibers, and allowed it to settle, then poured off the water and toasted the pulpy starch on a stick. Even with salt, it did not taste like much, but he found himself able to eat just about anything as the long weeks of walking wore on. Even more incredibly, he gained weight, though he was hungry from dawn to dusk. When their packs emptied, they didn't always have to live off the land. They stopped at isolated farmhouses and tiny hidden enclaves where the residents fed them, passing out bags of beans and corn flour to the 100-odd campers resting in their fields. Valentine practiced with his pistol. The wolves passed a hat around and collected 2 dozen bullets from the men with handguns that used the same ammunition as his. Some of the wolves carried up to 3 sidearms in order to have a better chance at using bullets acquired from scavenging the deceased after a fight. Valentine plinked away at old paint cans and weathered paint-stripped road signs. It was during one of these marksmanship sessions in an old barn near camp that Valentine made an effort to talk to Sergeant Samuels. He had just knocked down a row of 3 aluminum cans, their colored labels illegible with the passage of years, and he was feeling pretty full of himself.
You should try it with your left hand.
That cleaned the self-satisfied smile from Valentine's face in a hurry.
Why, Sergeant?
What if your right arm's busted, kid? What if someone just blew your hand off? I know most instructors say it's a waste of time. Me? I think it's good to use your offhand. Makes your brain and body work different than it's used to.
Valentine set one of the cans back up, the sharp cordite smell tickling his nostrils. Feeling awkward, he raised the gun to eye level, feet shoulder-width apart. He sent the can flying with the second shot.
May I?
Valentine passed him the gun. The sergeant examined it professionally.
This was your dad's?
No, Sergeant. I suppose he's a neighbor. He gave it to me.
Gun like this? It's in great shape. He must have thought a lot of you.
He handed the gun back to Valentine.
More like he thought a lot of my parents.
He paused for a moment, not sure how to phrase the question.
You seem to think a lot of my father, too. I never knew about his life before he met my mother. He just said he traveled.
Samuels glanced out the missing barn doors. The campsite was nearly empty. A heavy patrol was out under the lieutenant, and most of the recruits were taking advantage of the afternoon off to wash clothes and bathe in the nearby river.
Yeah, David, I knew him. Not from way back, from before the skies filled with ash, that is. We met in Michigan, soon after all this shit started. I was younger than you then, maybe 15. Your dad and I were in this outfit. We called ourselves the Band. Fighting sometimes. Hiding, mostly. Cops, army guys, we had some Coast Guard sailors from Lake Michigan, even. The uniform was a hat with a piece of camouflage material sewn on it somewhere. God, what a hungry, sorry-looking bunch we were. Even when we were blasting away at the grogs, we couldn't really believe it. It was like something out of a sci-fi movie. No one knew shit about what was going on. I used to cry every damn night, it seemed to me. My parents were in Detroit when the nuke went off, you see. I learned one thing. Tears make you feel better, but they don't change anything. You'll still be hungry when they dry up, still be lonely.
The two men, one mature and weathered, the other a few years past puberty, wandered out of the barn and watched the sun descend into the western haze. Samuels nodded to a couple of the wolves carrying out camp duties. Then he sat down on the corpse of an old green tractor. The space where the engine once sat gaped, an open wound with wires dangling.
So you were both wolves then?
Valentine omitted the sir, since they were both sitting.
Nah, that came later. God, we didn't know what to think. The rumors we heard, stuff about government experiments, that the apocalypse was here and Satan walked the earth. People getting rounded up into camps like in the Nazi movies. Creatures from outer space. Turned out the truth was even weirder than the rumors, of course. Seems to me we were trying to make for this Mount Omega. There was talk that the vice president was there with what was left of the government and the Joint Chiefs. Only problem with it was no one knew where Mount Omega was. And then we came across the Padre. The Padre was working for someone named Roe. Not that he'd given up on Holy Mother Church, of course. He said this Roe was very special and was advising us on how to fight these things. We weren't interested. He said Roe was holed up in a safe place with food, liquor, women. I can't remember what all he promised us. None of us were interested in that either. We'd been almost trapped and killed by those kind of promises before. The Quislings were already running us down. Then the Padre said that this Roe knew what was going on. That got us, especially your father. Some of the guys said that it was another trap, but I went with your dad because he'd done a good job looking after me. It turned out this Roe was a life weaver. He looked like a doctor from TV, really distinguished in everything. I guess you know who the Life Weavers are, living with the Padres, you did. He gave us this speech about doors to other planets and vampires and vital auras and how the Grogs were things cooked up in a lab. We didn't buy any of it. I remember some of the guys started singing, "Row, row, row your boat," sort of having fun with him. We thought he and the Padre were a couple of fucking nuts, you know? He said something to the Padre, and then I swear to Jesus, he turns into this big gold eagle with flames for wings, circled over us like the Hindenburg going up. None of us knew whether to shit or shoot, I can tell you. Your dad told us to quiet down, and it turned back into a man again, or the image of one. Believe me, after that we listened. He told us about a group of Life Weavers on a planet called Kerr. They'd learned from some touchstones the secret of how to live off vital auras. To beings with lifespans of thousands of years, the chance to have a lifespan of millions must have been temptation. Too much temptation. They violated the Life Weaver law, their moral code, and started absorbing aura. They were trying to become immortal in the interests of science, of progress. According to Roe, what they accomplished instead was to turn their world into a nightmare. They became what we call vampires, beings that are, to us, immortal. They do this through taking the lives of others. These rogue Life Weavers, the Kurians, became the mortal enemies of the rest of their race. The Kurians smashed Life Weaver society. They've been transformed from researchers and scientists into something else. Cold, ruthless. They used their skills to destroy all opposition. Overwhelmed, all the Life Weavers could do was shut the portals to Kerr. I guess it was an attempt to keep the infection from spreading. But it was too late. A few Kurians had already escaped and were using the Inner World Tree to attack the whole Life Weaver Order. More doors were shut, but that only cut the Life Weavers off, stopping them from organizing an effective resistance. It was like a house full of people, each hiding from a pack of killers in separate locked rooms, instead of banding together to fight.
The sound of galloping hooves interrupted the story. A rider on one of the three horses in the group pulled up in the yard.
Sarge!
The rider walked his horse in a circle.
The lieutenant says there's a Grog column out east of here, heading this way, mounted on legworms. 4 legworms, 20 Grogs altogether. Not coming right for us, but definitely looking. You're supposed to gather everyone up and get to the Highway 41 bridge. If the lieutenant hasn't shown up by tomorrow, you're supposed to get everyone to Round Spring Cave.
Got it, Vault. Now ride on down to the river and get the kids in gear. Slowly. Don't scare them out of a year's life like you did me.
The courier moved his roan off at a more sedate pace.
Damn, but the Grogs are far out from Omaha. Maybe someone saw us outside Des Moines. A lot of Quislings live in this area nowadays.
The sergeant gathered up the 6 wolves remaining at the camp and issued orders. He motioned Valentine over.
Sarge?
Samuels pulled at the beard sprouting on his chin.
Valentine, we're going to be marching tonight. We're going to stick to an old road because I want to get some miles south of the Grogs. But that means I've got to have scouts and a rear guard. I'm short-handed, but with the lieutenant and his group out. That means you're getting what's called a battlefield promotion. I'm going to put you in charge of the ass end of the recruit column. Make sure everyone keeps up. It's going to be 6 kinds of dark tonight with these clouds, so that won't be easy. Lucky for us, we've been slacking all afternoon. Can you handle that?
Yes, Sergeant!
Valentine threw out his chest, but nervous sweat was running down his back. Already, a few recruits were returning to the area around the old barn, some with wet clothes plastered to their bodies. They broke camp. Usually, the shouts and curses of the wolves trying to get their green recruits to move faster came from simple habit. But this time, the words were in earnest. They moved off into the deepening night. Before, they had done night marches only when arcing around Des Moines. The Grogs out of eastern Nebraska patrolled this area. They could follow a trail in day or night by sight, by ear, or by smell. They moved at a forced march with Valentine bringing up the rear. They walked and walked fast for 50 minutes, then rested for 10. The sergeant kept up a punishing pace. Complaints started after the fourth rest. By the sixth, there was trouble. A recruit named Winslow couldn't get to her feet. Her face was contorted in pain.
Ugh! My legs, Val. They've cramped up.
More water, less hooch, Winslow. The Sarge warned you. Don't come crying to me.
The column began to move. Gabby Cho, who had been keeping Valentine company at the rear, looked at him wonderingly. Valentine waved her off.
Get going, we'll catch up.
Valentine began massaging Winslow's quadriceps and calves. He tried to stretch one leg. Insects chirped and buzzed all around in the night air.
Just leave me, Val. When it wears off, I'll jog and catch up.
Can't do it, Winslow.
He heard the three wolves of the rear guard approach. It was now or never.
Up, Winslow. If you can't walk, you can hobble. I'll help you.
Valentine reached out a hand, grabbed hers, and tried to pull her up.
That's an order. But I'm not going to carry you. You've got to move along the best you can.
The wolves, rifles out of sheaths, looked at Valentine with raised eyebrows. They thought the situation humorous. A cramp-stricken recruit and would-be non-com trying to get her up by issuing orders with a voice that kept cracking. Finner was one of the rear guard.
What's going on? You two picked a hell of a time to hold hands in the moonlight.
She wants us to leave her.
No, she doesn't.
Okay, Winslow.
Valentine drew his gun.
I've given you an order, and you're not obeying it. I'm not leaving you to get found and made to talk about us or where we're going.
The words sounded odd. Do people really talk like this?
So I guess I'll have to shoot you.
Oh, Val, you've got to be joking.
Valentine looked at Finner, who shrugged.
Oh, see, Finner? I can barely crawl.
Move it, Winslow!
Samuels met them at the rear of the column.
Christ, Sarge, you tried to kill me.
As Winslow finished telling her end of the story, she shot a wounded look at Valentine. The sergeant planted a boot in her scrawny behind, then slammed fist and palm together.
Keep up next time, Winslow. Valentine.
The two men waited while the file drew away.
Don't ever use your gun except as a last resort on the enemy. Not out of consideration to that non-hacker, because the grogs can hear like bats. You get me?
Sorry, Sergeant. Only thing I could think of to get her moving. Her legs were cramped up, she said.
Next time, kick him in the ass. If that doesn't work, you come get me.
I thought you said I was responsible for keeping them moving, sir.
Sergeant Samuels considered this, then fell back on old reliable.
Shut up, smartass. I didn't give you permission to pull a gun on anyone. Get back in line. Keep them moving.
Finner, drawing nearer with the rear guard, had a few words with the sergeant. Samuels doubled the column, returning to the front.
Hey, Valentine.
Finner jogged up to him.
Don't worry about it. You tried to get her on her feet when most guys in your spot would have turned to us. Don't let the Sarge BS you about the gunshot. A single shot is tough to locate unless you're next to it. Plus, that thing doesn't make all that much noise. I told the Sarge that if I thought there was a problem, I wouldn't have let you do it.
What did he say?
He said I shouldn't think too much. It was dangerous for a guy like me. He added a few comments about my mother, too.
A cloud, shaped like a snail with an oversized shell on its back, began to cover the rising moon.
I think he'd take a bullet for you, though, Jess.
Damn straight.
The lieutenant was not at the rendezvous. The tired recruits and tireless wolves rested for 4 hours. At dawn, the sergeant sent Vaught on his horse with three wolves to scout the other side of the two-lane metal bridge spanning the Missouri. The land sloped upward as the wooded hills began beyond. Safety. One of the rear guard, at a copse of trees half a mile up the highway, waved a yellow bandana. Samuels clapped Valentine on the back.
Come on, son. You deserve to see this after last night. Everyone else get across the bridge.
He jogged off northward along the edge of what was left of the road, and Valentine followed. They reached the stand of trees. One of the wolves had a spotting scope resting in the crotch of a young oak, pointing down the highway. Valentine could make out figures in the distance, but he was unwilling to believe what he saw. Samuels looked through the scope.
They must have got wind of us last night. Not sure how many of us there are, so they're going back to report. Take a look at this freak show, Valentine.
David put his eye to the scope. The enemy. They were apish figures sitting astride a long pencil of flesh. The mount was like a shiny, slug-skinned millipede. Hundreds of tiny legs moved too fast for the eye to follow, reminding him of a finger running across a piano keyboard. The riders, five in all, had armor-like gray skin that reminded Valentine of a rhinoceros's hide. Their shoulders were wide, almost two axe handles across. They carried guns that looked like old Kentucky long rifles held pointed into the air like five waving antennae. Valentine wondered if he could even aim one of the six-foot weapons.
They're even uglier from the front. Those are 50 caliber single-shot breech loaders, Valentine, and they're handy with them. They can blow your head off at 1,000 yards if you're fool enough to be visible and not moving.
Those are grogs.
Valentine couldn't tear himself away from the eyepiece. The sergeant retrieved the scope.
Those legworms are fun to stop, too. Brain is at the tail end, kind of like Finner here. Nothing up front but a mouth and some taste buds, I guess. Also, like Finner here, come to think of it. Nothing short of a cannon will keep a legworm from coming at you. Good thing they're kind of slow.
One of the other wolves nodded in agreement.
We try to pick off the riders, but the lead one always has a big riot shield, thick as tank armor. We have to get them from the side. One thing you do not want to ever see is about 50 of them coming at you in line abreast.
That happened at the Battle of Cedar Hill. We lost.
They made it across the Missouri on a Sunday. The sergeant led them in a prayer of thankfulness that their long journey was almost complete. The next few days had briefer, harder runs, mixed with walks and 10-minute breaks. They stayed away from the roads, and the grog patrols stayed out of the hills, as each side considered this border region bushwhack ground. Around the campfire one night, Samuels told Valentine a little more about his father, how the Lifeweaver Row had created a special body of men to fight the Reapers and their allies, the Hunters.
He told us that these things had come to Earth once before. Some of Rose's people had taught men how to fight them. We'd forgotten it, except maybe as legends and myths garbled over the years. They took certain men and made them a match for what they were up against. Rose said he could do the same now if we were willing to accept the bargain. But it would change us forever. We'd never be the same people again. Your father was willing. Soon he had the rest of us convinced. That was the beginning of a lot of hard years, son. But when you get to the Ozarks, you'll see that it was worth it.
The lieutenant was waiting for them at Round Spring Cave. It was a road-hardened group that was welcomed by the officers in charge of training new blood in the Ozark Free Territory. A welcoming banquet was spread out under the trees. 6 weeks' worth of traveling on foot made the feast even more welcome. There was fresh bread, watermelons the size of hog's heads, meat from the fatted calf, the fatted hog, and the fatted chickens under the summer sky. Valentine ate an entire cherry pie at one sitting for the first time in his life. Another little cluster of would-be soldiers had arrived the day before, youths gathered from the Missouri Valley in the Dakotas. They swapped good stories and bad in the pseudo-hard-bitten fashion of youth. Gabby Cho shared a picnic table with Valentine under a spread of pine trees. The fresh, clean scent reminded him of Christmases before the death of his family. Valentine was experimenting with iced dandelion tea sweetened almost to syrup. The tea, ice in summer, and apparently plentiful sugar were all novelties to him.
We made it, Davy.
She looked a little older now to Valentine. She had chopped her long black locks after the second day of hot marching out of the boundary waters.
I wonder what's next. You're in with these wolf guys. Any idea what's up?
Not sure, Gab. I'd like to spend a few days sleeping.
Cho seemed unsure of herself.
Why'd you join up?
Valentine shot her a questioning look. Cho had remained distant on the whole trip south whenever any personal topic arose. She politely rebuffed the other recruit's attempts to get to know her. He rattled his ice in the pewter mug, enjoying the sound and the cool, wet feel.
You
would probably think revenge because of the whole family thing. You know about what happened, right?
Yes, David. From some of the guys at class. I asked the Padre about it once. He told me to ask you, but I didn't want to do that.
Well, it's not that.
Are you sure? A voice in his head asked.
I know now my dad was with these wolves. Maybe he would have wanted me to do it too. He must have thought it was worthwhile. He spent a lot of years at it.
Valentine paused at a rustle overhead. Squirrels, attracted by the masses of food, were chasing each other around in the tree branches, sending flecks of bark falling onto the pair below. They were cute, but they made a decent stew, too.
I want to make a difference, Gab. It's obvious. Something's not right about the way things are. You know that Jefferson stuff we used to read? About being endowed by our Creator with inalienable rights. It's like those rights of ours have been taken away, even the right to live. We have to do something about it.
As simple as that?
As simple as that, Gabby. What about you?
Did you know I had a baby?
Valentine absorbed the news in awkward silence, then cleared his throat.
No. You just disappeared from school, went north with your family, I thought.
We kept it quiet. The father was a patroller.
She read Valentine's eyes.
No, it wasn't like that. I knew him. His name was Lars. Lars Jorgensen.
David got the feeling that she had not said the name in a long time.
He used to give me stuff. Nice clothes, shoes. I never thought to ask where it came from. Looted stores in Duluth, I figured. One day he gave me a watch. A real working watch. I could tell there had been engraving on it, even though he had tried to scratch it off. I told him not to give me any more presents. He disappeared when I told him about the baby coming.
Who's got the kid? Your mom, or?
Scarlet fever got her. Last winter. Remember the outbreak? It hit around where you were living, too. It took...
Jesus, Gabby. I'm so sorry.
She wiped her eyes.
I think about it too much. I talked to the Padre after it happened. I thought maybe I didn't take care of her right, not on purpose, but because of how I feel about the father. I just didn't know. The Padre put it down to a lack of qualified doctors. Or if they're good, they don't have the equipment or medicines. The Padre said that lots of people he knew put this kind of thing behind them by helping others. He gave me a lecture about the need for strong bodies and good minds. Got talking about the cause. Well, you know him.
I wonder if I do. He didn't talk to me like that.
She smiled her I've got the right answer smile from school.
I think he knew you would go south when the time was right. I wanted to tell you all this for some reason. I feel like someone has to know the real me here.
The recruits got the word from Captain Steam Engine Fulton. He gathered them on a little slope in a ring of trees. In this natural amphitheater, he spoke to the mass of youths from Minnesota, the Dakotas, and a smattering of Great Plains outposts.
You will form a reserve regiment for now. You will receive uniforms. You will be armed and you will be taught how to use those weapons. You will be paid, but not for fighting. Your main duties will be as disciplined labor force to be moved about the free territory, helping the residents at harvest, improving the roads, learning about how things are organized on the Ozark Plateau. The harder you work, the more there'll be to eat over the winter.
The bloody-minded and the phony tough guys groaned at the news, but Valentine grinned at Cho. A gun, a uniform, and something he had heard about but never seen, a paycheck. He couldn't wait to get started. The Ozark Plateau, the 40th year of the Kurian Order, an island of sanity in the eye of a hurricane of death, the scattered farms and towns of the Ozarks are a civilization under siege. The heartland of the region is bordered by the blasted ruins of Little Rock to the south, in the west by a line extending from the western Wachitas and Fort Scott to Springfield, Missouri, in the north by the far-flung foothills of the Ozarks and the Mark Twain Forest, and to the east by the St. Francis River, known by some as the Ozark Free Territory and by the more military-minded as the Southern Command. The region supports 750,000 survivors. They are mostly farmers and ranchers, connected by a network of poor roads and unreliable rivers flowing through the worn-down remnants of America's oldest mountains. Heavy stands of oak, hickory, and pine give these hills a bluish tinge, fed by cool streams winding through limestone gorges. The small mountains have bare patches of exposed felsite and rhyolite, rocky scars that symbolize the flinty hardness beneath the exterior of the inhabitants. New farming centers have sprung up to replace the old. Little clusters of homes huddle together like medieval villages, stone walls with narrow loopholes facing the world, doors, windows, and porches facing the neighbors. The squatty settlements, perhaps built by men whose motto is "build for safety, not for comfort," are linked by walls that do not divide home from home, but separate houses from the outside. Corrugated aluminum barns and Quonset huts in the center of the ring of homes shelter livestock and machinery from the elements and thieves. Some areas are electrified, and a substantial portion use natural gas. A ham radio network maintains communication. Telephones are back in action, but service is unreliable. The suspicious and tough-minded residents dislike strangers, and they sleep with rifles and shotguns handy. Pack traders traverse the area with stock on muleback or in gaily painted wagons, bringing basic necessities and a few luxuries. Both necessities and luxuries are paid for with barter, sometimes with greenbacks. Perhaps a measure of the success and fortitude of the inhabitants of what used to be southern Missouri and much of Arkansas is their acceptance of paper currency as being worth something. But as gold coins can be changed at $2,000 or more dollars to the ounce, paper money's value is not what it once was. A regular Judge Advocate General Civil Relations Court, called the Jaggers, in a tone suggesting the word has an obscene connotation, rides circuit and brings some measure of order and law to the lives of the residents. A few towns operate in the region, home to the artisans and technicians that keep society together. There is still singing in Branson, and a riverboat casino is in operation on the White River, paying out prizes in a system of Byzantine complexity. A governor resides in Mountain Home, Arkansas, trying to keep the roads open and mail running on shoestring budgets. The soldiery, as the residents know them, are concentrated in the Wachita Mountains to the south and in the broken Ozark Ridges to the north. Ceaseless long-range patrols circle the area, picking up information and refugees from all points of the compass. Strong cavalry reserves train constantly in the center of the region, ready to go to the border to slow invasion or destroy a raid. Although the Ozark Free Territory is relatively safe, it is not impregnable, as small holders and settlements in the boundary areas learn the hard way. The uniform combined the comfort of burlap with the durability of cheesecloth. How innocent cotton minding its own business could be turned into such a scratchy, sagging patchwork amazed Valentine. And the rifle. It was a single-shot breech loader, operated by a lever that flipped out the expended case of the bullet. Woe to the recruit who failed to collect the hot brass thimble, as it opened the chamber for the insertion of another round. At least, that was the theory. In practice, a few shots heated the action sufficiently to soften the thin brass encasing the heavy bullet, and Valentine became better at clearing jams than shooting the quickly fouled weapon. It kicked like a mule and aimed with the ease of a steel shovel. However, it had few moving parts and was within the manufacturing capacity of the Ozark Free Territory. The pay was the biggest joke of all. The recruits received multicolored military scrip, usable at the scattered to the point of inaccessibility Southern Command trading post commissaries and accepted by a few pack traders desperate enough to take it in return for merchandise that failed the caveat emptor test everywhere else. Fulton pushed them through 2 months' worth of drill in an exhausting 6 weeks. A few recruits bristled at the discipline and gave it up after the first week, either trying the dangerous trip home or finding work on the farms and ranches of the territory. The majority finished their training under the supervision of bellowing NCOs. They ran and memorized the simple common articles that governed them and the territory. They ran and sat through lectures about recent United States history, about the other knots of the resistance in Oregon, Arizona, the Appalachians, and New England. They ran and practiced with their rifles, as well as the captured support weapons and the simple cannon produced in inadequate factories. They ran and learned about camp life, brain tanning, drying and smoking meat, planting, foraging, and where to find medicinal herbs. They ran and learned about running.
Fall out!
Labor Private Valentine learned to recognize the divisions of Southern Command: Guards, Militia, and Hunters. The largest body of professional soldiery was the Guards. They provided a solid core for the defense of the Ozark Free Territory. Sometimes the NCOs and officers were veterans of the Lifeweaver-trained Hunters. The Guards reinforced the Militia, the first line of defense for most communities. Most able-bodied adults, especially in the border areas, belonged to the militia. They drilled with the Guards one day a month and stood ready to assemble at the call of drum, whistle, or siren. The Hunters carried war into the Kurian zone. Trained by the Lifeweavers, they were divided into the wolf, bear, and cat castes, each with a unique duty to the cause. At talks given by members of the castes, Valentine learned that the wolves carried out long-range patrol duties and maintained communication between the other commands across North America. The cats, rarely seen in the territory, served as spies and saboteurs across the country, often leading double lives deep in the Kurian zone. The bears fought as the shock troops of the cause, the Reaper's most fearless and skilled enemies. A hunter usually started as a wolf, and some of the best stayed as wolves rather than moving to a different caste. There were a few that knew all three of the hunter's arts, as they named the Lifeweaver's disciplines, but all fought and sacrificed together to bring mankind back to a place in the sun. Valentine experienced the uneasy symbiotic relationship between the military and civilians when the labor regiment broke up into work squads and were dispersed to the surrounding farms for the harvest. The military could not understand why civilians seemed to begrudge every mouthful that went into the bodies of the men prepared to give their lives to protect them. The civilians failed to see why so much of what they produced, barely enough to feed the community in a good year, disappeared into a machine that often failed to keep them safe and showed flashes of competence and efficiency only when gathering the agreed-upon 15% tithe. The harvest came and went in a whirlwind of dawn-to-dusk labor. Valentine, in charge of Cho and eight other recruits between visits by an overworked officer, helped a dozen hard-working families in an enclave near the Arkansas-Missouri border. They built and repaired houses and barns, helped get in the crops, and then butchered and preserved the summer-fattened livestock. Most of the grain and corn filled a pair of silos at the center of the little defensive ring of homes called Weaning, but they also hid a reserve in a series of clay-lined pits set between Weaning's barns. They covered the pits with tarps and dirt and hoped the village dog and cat population would protect the edible buried treasure from scavenging rodents. Harvest Feast followed the weeks of frantic work. For 3 days, the recruits participated in athletics while daylight lasted, and then joined the farmers at long tables laden with roasts, hams, turkeys, chickens, side dishes, and desserts of every description at dinner. Valentine sat next to Cho and gorged himself, then retired, distended, to the militia barracks above the town stable for the nightly farting contest. With the food put away, literally and figuratively, a brief period of repair and maintenance ensured that the blockhouse homes and barns would keep their inhabitants in some measure of comfort for the winter. All the while, the oaks and hickories of the area turned red gold, until a period of dry, windy days whipped the leaves from their tethers and left the twigs dead and empty. Rumor suggested that Valentine's team would soon pull back into winter camp in the Wachitas. The labor crews in some of the neighboring villages had either left or were getting orders to do so. The farmer's generosity began to run out as soon as the last root cellar was filled and barrel of salted pork nailed shut. A family named Ross gave Valentine a padded overcoat stuffed with goose down and coated with a waxy waterproofing. Valentine had spent some of his few spare hours that fall raising the Ross children out of semi-literacy in well-remembered Father Max fashion, first reading to the kids from borrowed books and then having the children read the passages back to him. Weaning abutted Black River, a sandbar-clogged stream that flowed through a tunnel of black gum, oak, and river birch. Each night, even as the evenings grew cooler, Valentine waded out into one of the chilly, deeper pools for a bath. He had added another inch to his frame in the year since joining the cause, and his long-limbed physique was leaving its boyish scrawniness behind. Lean muscle coiled up in his arms and across work-widened shoulders brushed by his glossy black hair. His square-cut face was harder and his bronzed skin darker than he had ever seen before, but his eyes retained a youthful twinkle. Life in the Free Territory suited him. The work among the people of Weening was rewarding, and he had the memory of the Ross children swelling with pride as they sounded out compound words for him and their parents. He was happy. One November evening, with a chill in the air promising an even cooler dawn, David waded into the scrotum-tightening current for his nightly bath. A few frogs started up their musical croaking, but it was far from the ear-filling chorus of the summer nights. A heron, standing sentinel on a snag in midstream, eyed him suspiciously as he plunged into his twilight revivification.
Val, you're gonna stop this nonsense by Christmas, I hope.
Gabriella Cho sat beneath the tresses of a riverbank willow.
I'm all in favor of men that bathe. In fact, I wish you'd give lessons, but the river in this temperature?
I can't pass up the chance for a swim in November. Oh, we couldn't do this in the Boundary Waters, not at this time of year. You should try it.
She stepped into the veiled moonlight, holding a wicker laundry basket.
I'll stick to dipping a piece of me at a time in a wash basin, thank you. It's slower, but I can do without the double pneumonia. Anyway, I brought you a treat, you nut.
Valentine waded up and out of the stream, toes pleasantly digging into the cool sand. He felt no embarrassment at being naked in front of Cho. They'd shared too many rough camps for him to worry about modesty. She knelt, unwrapping one of the bundles from her basket, and then standing up again with the air of a magician performing a trick. The brick-heated towel she draped around his shoulders warmed him deliciously.
Oh, thanks, Gabby. This feels great. To what do I owe the royal treatment?
He began to dry himself off, goose-pimpling skin luxuriating in the welcome heat. Cho retrieved the other towel, stepped behind him, and affectionately tousled his hair.
It's winter quarters for us soon. I hear they're going to split us up into apprenticeships or something in camp.
She dried his back with a series of long strokes. He found it easy to be agreeable with his skin tingling the way it was.
That's the rumor.
You filled out a little. Used to be such a read. Too much time cooped up in Father Max's library.
Valentine felt a spark. Are you going where I think you're going? He wondered, applying it equally to the direction of the conversation and her rubdown. Now aware of how close she stood behind him and drinking in her rich feminine scent, he thought with a little nervous thrill how easy it would be to turn around and embrace. A shriek from the buildings on the other side of the belt of trees broke the moment like a thrown brick shattering a window. By the time Valentine pulled his pants on and stepped into his boots, he could hear the ringing from the metal tube in the gate watchtower that served as Weening's alarm gong.
Flames, Val, and... Jesus, what's that?
Something flapped across the night sky over the street, bigger than a vulture, banking to make another pass over the ring of houses. The two friends ran for the river gap, a narrow alley between two homes that served as the smaller of the two entrances to the village. Cho ran three paces ahead of Valentine, who was still fumbling with his pants. A shot flashed from one of the long rectangular windows just under the roof of the house overlooking the river gap. Cho staggered as the whipcrack hit Valentine's ears, a leg yanked out from under her as if someone had pulled it with a tripwire. Valentine waved his arms above his head.
Don't shoot! Don't shoot! It's us!
He dropped to the earth, crawling for Cho.
Shit! Bitch! Damn it!
He found her writhing in the undergrowth, clutching her injured left leg.
Val, my leg's broken. I think, help me. Christ, bleeding bad.
Don't shoot anymore!
Valentine peered into the flame-lit night. He pulled off his belt and cinched it around Cho's thigh as a tourniquet.
Send help out here, damn it! You shot her!
More shots rang out from somewhere, not aimed at them, thankfully. Valentine tried picking Cho up. A scared, witless voice called from the window.
That's you, Mr. Valentine?
He started to reply with profanity strong enough to blister paint, but cut it off.
I'm coming in! We need to get some help out here! Dorian Helm, right?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry, but when you came up so fast...
Never mind! Come out here! I want you to keep an eye on her. Get a good look at what happens when you shoot without knowing what you're shooting at.
Dylan, bring some water. David, the bleeding slowed. God, let them have chloroform or something.
And water, Helm! A canteen, anything!
He heard no response. Valentine turned back to Cho.
Hope he heard me. Just hold on for a little while. The two of you stay under these trees. Those flying things are busy lighting fires.
Gabby's eyes were squinted closed, and her lip was bleeding where she must have bitten it in pain.
Knock a couple down for me, Val. What a dumb way to get a hit.
Hang tough, Gab. Back in a few.
The Helm boy, 16 at most, and wide-eyed with fear, let him in the tall metal gate that barred entrance to the West Gap.
Mr. Valentine, I'd never have...
Valentine didn't hear the rest of what he said. He had no time for him, after seeing that the kid had recovered his wits enough to bring a blanket out for Cho. David Valentine reached the center of Weening without further shots aimed at him. Smoke streamed from the top of one of the silos, where two men climbed an exterior ladder, laden with blankets wrapped around their shoulders. Flames licked at the side of the main barn, the largest building in the center of the ring of walled houses. Two of his fellow reservists stood before the shed that contained their rifles. They were taking pot shots at the bat shapes circling above. Valentine ran for the shed, hunched over in expectation of claws digging into his head or shoulders any second. He retrieved his rifle and thrust a handful of cartridges into the pocket of his beltless pants, which threatened to drop to his ankles.
They're throwing Molotov cocktails, I think, Val.
The speaker, Pollock, was one of the would-be soldiers in Valentine's squad.
You can see them burn as they come down.
How many of them are there?
Valentine searched the skies. 30 feet away, some of the residents worked the hose attached to the powered pump, directing a thin stream of water at the fire threatening the barn. At the other side of the village, a mountain of a farmer, gray-haired Tank Bourne, held his automatic rifle at the ready under his porch. The weapon looked like a toy pressed against his massive shoulder. Bourne aimed a shot at the shape arcing around the barn, diving at the firefighters, short leg claws extended like an eagle after a fish. Valentine and his comrades' guns rang out at almost the same instant. The volley of shots brought the attacker crashing to earth. Another flapper appeared on the slanted roof of the Bourne house, crawling down the shingles with leather-draped arms toward Bourne. Valentine chambered a fresh round, sighted, and fired. Bourne heard either creature or bullet and came out from under the porch roof. Bourne pumped shells into the abomination. It turned over and rolled off the roof.
That's two down.
His heart was pounding in his ears. Pollock was pointing.
Look, Valentine, the main hayloft's on fire!
Framed in the growing red-orange-yellow light of the burning hay, an ungainly shape waddled toward the upper doors from deep inside the loft. Tottering on short bow legs, it pulled itself along with long arms like a webbed spider monkey. Two triangular ears jutted like sharp horns from its angular head. Tank Bourne rested on one knee, feeding a fresh magazine into his rifle. Valentine and the reservist shot, apparently without effect as the bat thing launched itself into the air, with a series of audible flaps like clotheslined sheets whipped by the wind. The beast disappeared into the smoke above. Bourne waved them toward the already burning barn.
We have to get the stock out of there!
The hay, now well alight, threatened to take not only Weening's central structure, but much of its livestock as well. Bourne, Valentine, and a handful of men dashed inside, throwing the lower doors all the way open. Rising heat whipped the wind inside. The men pulled, pushed, and cajoled the stupefied cattle, which stood frozen in their stalls, away from the flames. Weening's few horses needed little encouragement, but added to the Noah's Ark confusion in the great barn's lower level as they danced and collided in their rush for the door. Once the men coaxed a few cows into moving, the rest took to the idea with a will and followed the horses. The pair who dared climb the ladder covered by every available gun, fought the fire on the roof of the silo. Valentine prayed there wouldn't be an explosion. Bullets felled two more bat things as they tried to pluck the men from the heights. They extinguished the most immediate threat to the village. Layers of corrugated iron and shingles bought enough time for the coughing men to beat the fire into submission with water-soaked blankets. As the gunfire died down, women and children emerged to help combat the blaze with bucket chains and another canvas hose. The main barn could not be saved, but the smaller buildings, coops, and pens that stood near it in the center of town stayed wet, thanks to brave souls who dared the heat of the burning barn to douse them with buckets of water. Bourne, rifle held ready at his chest, still watched the skies.
Those harpies haven't been in these parts in years. When I was with the bears, we caught a couple hundred of them in daylight. Burned them out of an old bank they were sleeping in. Shot them out of the sky in daylight, easy. They're big, slow targets compared to a duck on the wing.
Slow?
Yes. They're better gliders than they are flyers, especially if they're loaded with grenades. They're pretty smart, at least enough to know when to attack and when to try to get away.
Would they fly in the day?
I doubt it. Too much of a chance of a patrol seeing them.
Valentine felt his pulse quicken.
They hit us within an hour of sunset. How far could they fly in that hour, Mr. Bourne?
Tank looked at him, bushy eyebrows raised in interest.
I see where you're headed, young man. They'd be flying against the wind out of the east. I don't think they'd be more than 15 miles away. 10's more likely.
Valentine belatedly remembered Cho.
I've got a wounded man on the west gate. Can you help me get her in? After that, I want to find out which way they went when they flew off.
There's a stretcher in the tack shed where you keep your gear. I'll help you bring her in. We don't have a doctor anywhere hereabouts.
They found the young helm boy propped up against a tree, eyes gaping and empty. His neck had a ragged hole in it just below the Adam's apple. The wound looked as if someone had probed his chest cavity with an oversized drill. Cho was missing. Whatever took place at the West Gap had happened so fast that the boy couldn't even get off a shot with his carbine, which lay fully loaded and broken in half on either side of his body.
There's a hood nearby. Poor kid. He was dead before he knew what was happening.
Could Cho still be alive?
Maybe. He'd fed off Dorian here. Broke his neck, then went for the blood. Chewed a hole in his neck and stuck its tongue right into his heart. Ever seen a reaper tongue? Pointed at the end, like a big rubbery syringe.
Guilt hammered at Valentine with a string of precisely aimed blows.
You left Cho unprotected in the open. Watched by a kid who shouldn't even have been responsible for covering the west gate from a loophole. You pulled him out of his house and left him in his own backyard to get his heart pierced. Two people are dead because you couldn't stand hurting an injured buddy by moving her. Nice work, Valentine. Kurians need a few more like you giving orders.
All the more reason to make them wish they had tried someone else's friends, a stronger part of him countered.